Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What legacy will Hugo Chavez leave on the country he ruled for 14 years, and how will Venezuela's future play out under a new leader? Chavez died last month after a lengthy battle with cancer, leaving most of his six-year term unexpired. Special elections to choose a successor are set for April 14th, and many see Chavez's hand-picked successor, interim President Nicolas Maduro, as a clear frontrunner. But how did a man from such humble beginnings as Chavez rise to prominence in the first place? And how did his time as president affect how ordinary Venezuelans expect their government to act at home and its relationships with the broader world? Journalist Rory Carroll is former Latin American bureau chief for The Guardian. His new biography of Chavez is called Comandante, Hugo Chavez's Venezuela. Rory, welcome to Think.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for having me.
So the news of Chavez's death last month, of course, was not unexpected. Has anything surprised you about the response among people in Venezuela?
Not really. We've been sort of bracing for almost for 2 years for the announcement of his death. And when it came, there was this huge outpouring of emotion for him. I was in Caracas for that. And, hundreds of thousands of people swarmed down from these hilltop barrios, the slums, which were Chavez's support base, just to express their grief and sorrow that he had passed. And that was no surprise. And also the fact that the way the government has done its best to squeeze every ounce of emotion out of this for its own political benefit is also hardly a surprise, to the point that we now see Chavez's ghost, if you like, invoked on a daily basis, repeatedly, by the government.
Venezuela is often described as deeply divided these days. Can you talk about the lines of class and political persuasion that those divisions lie along?
Yeah, the short version is that the poor loved Chavez and the wealthy despised him. And, there's some truth in that, but it was, as ever, of course, much more complicated as well, because the poor were grateful to him for handouts and subsidies, and the fact that an oil boom coincided with his rule, and he lavishly spent this oil boom on social projects. So they did adore him. But many of the poor also suffered the most from his policies, especially the neglect of the judicial system, for instance, which fueled an explosion in crime. And it's the poor who have been bearing the brunt of violence and murder rates, also inflation, kind of reckless populism, also kind of half ruined the economy, and it's the poor who suffer that. So there is this. There are quite a number of poor people who actually have problems with Hugo Chavez. And similarly, on the side of the wealthy, there is a new elite called the Boligarchs, which is a coined term, co-joining oligarchs with Simon Bolivar, who was Hugo Chavez's hero. And these Boligarchs were people with connections with the government who were basically friends or friendly with Hugo Chavez and made fortunes during his government. And so they remain loyal to his memory. So although the poor liked Chavez and the wealthy hated him, true, but within that there were lots of subplots.
So what are the most significant political and ideological differences between the interim president, Mr. Maduro, and his challenger, Enrique Capriles, who unsuccessfully, is this right, ran against Hugo Chavez last fall?
Yes, well, Enrique Capriles, who's a young governor, he's only 40 years old, and he represents Miranda State, which includes Caracas. He is styling himself as a centrist in the mold of Lula of Brazil, mm-hmm. And saying that he wants to rule in kind of in a social democratic way, continuing basically some populist policies, but with more attention to supporting the private sector and having a more kind of pragmatic economy. Whereas Nicolas Maduro, Chavez's designated heir, is promising to continue the same policies of his late chief, meaning extending state control over more areas of the economy, basically harassing the private sector, and spending lavishly on social programs. And so it's not, I think it's more Maduro's model is more populist, really, than classically socialist. It's certainly not Cuban-style communism.
So how did Chavez's time in Venezuela change the way the country is seen in the broader Latin American community?
Well, before Chavez, Venezuela was largely seen as perhaps the most boring country in Latin America. It was this land which exported oil and beauty queens. And that was about it. It had set out much of the turmoil, the revolutions and coups of the Cold War. And it was considered this rather land that was blessed with lots of oil and money, but basically was rather materialistic, rather shallow, and maybe a bit kind of vulgar. That was the kind of the stereotype of many South Americans towards Venezuela. Until, of course, Hugo Chavez arrived, and he completely changed perceptions of Venezuela. For many, Venezuela became and still is this beacon of revolutionary ferment, of Latin American pride, that here was a president who created a movement that stood up to the Yankee imperialist superpower that for centuries had meddled in Latin America. Here was a guy who put the poverty first and foremost at the center of his political discourse. And those would be what his friends or supporters in Latin America would see. Critics in Latin America, and I must point out that Chavez was often very unpopular, actually, in Latin America. He was on a par, according to opinion polls, with George Bush. A lot of Latin Americans, ordinary Latin Americans, were suspicious of him. And the reason being, they felt that they saw the uniform, they heard the bombast, they saw these kind of stories of kind of radicalization, and some Latin Americans thought, uh-oh, we've seen this movie before, and it doesn't end well, meaning that in they've seen the kind of military dictatorships or military rule in their own lifetimes, and they were suspicious of it. Now, Chavez's type of military rule is actually quite different, and he was elected. I mean, he was never a dictator, but his policies were sufficiently radical and, in the end, ruinous of Venezuela's economy that many Latin Americans look to Venezuela not as a model of revolutionary ferment so much as a case study of an experiment gone terribly wrong.
Well, no matter how one feels about his leadership, no one would call Hugo Chavez boring, as you mentioned. Really a fascinating character. Tell us a little bit, Rory, about his childhood.
He was born on the plains of Barinas, which are these kind of wild, kind of dusty plains, sort of the prairies of Venezuela, into poverty. His parents were school teachers, but they did okay. I mean, they had like the kind of humble circumstances, but that was quite typical for the Venezuela of its day. And young Hugo appeared to have had a very happy childhood growing up. He spent a lot of time with his grandmother, and he showed from early on a passion for singing, for poetry, for reading. He was a bookworm, and for sports. He was a very talented pitcher in baseball. And in fact, that was what he wanted to be as he grew up as a teenager. He decided he wanted to play in the major leagues. And so he actually joined the army, thinking that this would be his fast track into getting a sports scholarship. So it was a very unusual route into politics for Hugo Chavez.
And certainly his grandmother was an influence on his life. And he was raised on these sort of family mythology, myths of rebellious hero ancestors.
Yes, I mean, he grew up listening to tales and legends of the plains. Often they were kind of ghost stories, tales of the headless rider, and also mixed in with folklore, even from his own family. He had his great-grandfather was a character called Maisanta, whom, depending who you spoke to, was either this a cutthroat outlaw bandit, or he was a kind of Robin Hood-type rebel trying to, combat the forces of oligarchy. And Chavez grew up listening to these stories, and he just fell in love with them. I mean, he just loved the songs and poems of the plains, and he had an extraordinary memory. He could recite stanza after stanza of these poems decades later, and he used this in his political discourse. And this kind of sense of kind of also magical realism that pervaded that area of Venezuela was something that Chavez very much imbibed, and he brought that much of that culture with him into the palace in Caracas once he took power.
So he joined the army in hopes that he could secure a baseball scholarship, but then it turned out he loved the military.
He did. I mean, he was just suddenly a fish splashing into water. It was the uniforms, the drills, the camaraderie, the sense of structure, that he just loved it. And he, in his letters home, especially to his grandmother, he would detail these anecdotes about him marching, you know, through these little villages and the little children, you know, coming up watching in awe as he and his comrades kind of marched through. And also the machine guns, and he was, oh, my grandmother, you should have seen me there. I was rat tat tat tat. I was firing away. It was fantastic. And you know, he was a happy guy. He loved this, and he, you know, he was quite successful rising up through the ranks. I mean, he was promoted from a cadet into being a lieutenant, and then he was put on a fast track into the military hierarchy.
So you mentioned earlier that Chavez was deeply inspired by the leadership of Simón Bolívar in achieving Latin America's independence from Spain. What part of Bolívar's goals did Chavez feel were still unfulfilled and were sort of left for him to realize?
He felt that Bolívar had only half completed his mission, that in the 19th century he managed to expel the Spanish overlords and deliver independence to Venezuela, but that independence was then subsequently sort of ambushed or undermined by these kind of plutocratic oligarchs who ruled Venezuela and were sort of these kind of almost still an alien implant, and that they kept people in poverty. And so he felt that Venezuela needed a second revolution which would liberate the country from the poor and basically introduce a new ruling class that would be much more patriotic and more aware of Venezuela's history, and that this should be the Venezuelan model rather than this rather kind of shallow materialism that seemed to be trying to ape the United States in terms of its love of cars and shopping malls. And that was why he felt that Venezuela needed a second liberation, and with him being, of course, the liberator.
Yeah, he thinks, I'm the guy to do this. How did he begin to formulate plans for that revolution?
He, from a very early age, when he was still just a lieutenant colonel, so he would have been in his mid-20s, he began to dream of insurrection. So he was still a serving officer, but he started spending time. His older brother, Adan, was a radical student activist who had made friends with communist intellectuals and communist guerrillas. And Chavez, on his off time, would actually hang out with these guys, and he'd talk to them and read their books. And he became entranced with the idea that he could lead an insurrection against the Venezuelan state. So he spent about 15 years plotting and preparing a coup, and he was secretly recruiting allies and comrades into this plot, which finally happened in 1992, by which time he was a lieutenant colonel.
My guest is Rory Carroll, former Latin American bureau chief for The Guardian and author of the new book, Comandante, Hugo Chavez's Venezuela. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, where you can design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in human rights, global studies, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with journalist Rory Carroll, former Latin American bureau chief for The Guardian and author of Comandante, Hugo Chavez's Venezuela. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Rory, how did that coup attempt play out?
Disastrously and miraculously. Chavez, despite having had so much time to prepare it, more than a decade, it was a military fiasco. He failed to kind of basically reach his objectives, and he was trapped, and the whole thing collapsed within 24 hours. But the government, which of that day was democratically elected but extremely unpopular, made a catastrophic mistake. They allowed the then unknown Lieutenant Colonel Hugo Chavez to make a televised surrender announcement, which it seemed a good idea at the time because they thought, well, they want him to get his guys to lay down their arms. So they allow him on television without realizing, because nobody knew at that time, just what a media savvy operator this guy was. And he just had 2 minutes to give his surrender address on live TV, and he was very careful to make sure that he looked, despite the fact the whole thing had unraveled, and I mean, he made himself very, very crisp. He had his arms red beret. He made sure his military uniform was crisp, and he gave without any script. He just took responsibility for the coup, and he said that he urged his men to lay down their weapons, and he said that their objectives had not been achieved por ahora, for now. Meaning or implying that he would intend to come back at a future date to complete the mission. Now, the impact was electric because people thought, who is this guy? I mean, who and what? And he's saying Puerto Water, he means he's going to come back? And, of course, a lot of people were excited by that because the government is just so unpopular. And people, it made him a star right there and then. Because he was just so eloquent and so fluent and so dashing and appeared so much in charge. He had such presence in front of the camera. So that even though he went to prison, he went to jail for 2 years, he was such a star, a media star, that the government actually felt compelled to release him. They pardoned him, and they released him back into Venezuela, and whereupon he launched himself for the presidency, this time using the ballot box.
How did he spend that time in prison?
Doing lots of interviews was one thing. Venezuelan journalists couldn't get enough of him. I mean, they were queuing literally outside the door to speak to him. He wrote a lot of letters, and he also tried to settle a few kind of fraught relationships with his comrades because some of his own allies, who were also jailed along with him, were not happy that he was suddenly taking all of the limelight because they had felt the coup had been a collaborative enterprise, and yet here was Hugo taking over all of the limelight, and so he had to kind of manage these relationships as well. So by the time he came out 2 years later, he was in a pretty good position to launch a political career.
Yeah, it's interesting that being behind bars actually gave him a chance to effectively get media trained.
Yeah, media trained, and also he had supposed economic training. There was a university professor at the time called Jorge Giordani who went to the prison to give him tutorials in governance. And Giordani was a student, a professor of public policy, and he basically adopted Chavez as a pupil. And Chavez was doing a thesis in how to run a government and an economy with Giordani as his mentor. And, as it turned out, Giordani subsequently became his economic czar, like his kind of guru figure who ran the Chavista economy and still does to this day. So it was a very fateful meeting and collaboration at that time.
So talk a little bit about the campaign for the 1998 presidential elections.
It was Beauty and the Beast, the headlines put it. Because the opposition, the traditional establishment parties, backed a former Miss Venezuela as a beauty queen to be their candidate, and so they rallied around her, and polls gave her a strong advantage. And Chavez started out with a rather ramshackle coalition of small left-wing parties and grassroots activists, and yet he was able to, he basically crushed her in debate because she was a lightweight. I mean, her policies, she didn't really have many policies apart from let's all be nicer to each other and let's clean the streets, whereas Chavez was much more the insurrection candidate. He was much more radical and tough in his rhetoric. And that's what Venezuelans wanted to hear, because in 1998, Venezuela was exhausted. Its petrol boom from the 1970s and 1980s had run into the sand. Petrol prices, oil prices had collapsed, and with it, Venezuela's economy. And its traditional system of representative democracy was exhausted. The two main political parties were mired in corruption, and they were ossified, basically. And the system was crying out for something new, and Chavez was that something new.
So Chavez had this appeal to the poor. What specifically did he promise to them, and how great was their influence? How many of them were sort of actively voting before Chavez ran for president?
He promised, above all, vengeance, in a way. Vengeance on a broken system and on corruption. Because in Venezuela, it's often been the case that people blame, when times get tough, as they invariably do when oil prices fall, they blame the problems not on a dysfunctional working of a petrostate, but on corruption. If I am poor, it's because someone has stolen the money, and that someone is the government. And Chavez was the perfect vehicle for that message, and so the poor felt this is the guy to punish those who've stolen from us, those thieves in government, and he will be our agent of vengeance against them. And so that's why they voted for him. And until then, Venezuela had not a bad turnout in terms of the poor would go to the polls because it was a representative democracy, and the established political parties used to do their own giveaways, handouts, and subsidies to mobilize the poor to make sure that their own guys would win power. So initially, there was nothing especially unusual about the high amounts of the large numbers of poor people that turned out to vote for Chavez in 1998.
How did Chavez choose the people that would work closest to him in the version of Venezuela that is the White House? Is it the name of the White House in Venezuela?
Miraflores
Palace, right.
He relied on several sources. The most important one was the armed forces, because that was an institution he knew. He had spent his entire adult life in the military, and he knew all these officers. He had mentored many of them, and others had been his own bosses or commanders. And those he respected, he brought into government. In some cases, they stayed in uniform, but they became minister for water or minister for various things. And also, he encouraged them to become regional governors or to run for mayor. A second source were kind of left-wing movements and left-wing intellectuals. And in some cases, these guys were maybe kind of quasi-Marxists or full-fledged Marxists, who had been working in universities and think tanks, and they became sort of an intellectual ballast for his government. But also, he had a lot of, especially at the beginning, pragmatists, businessmen, because he spoke and sounded like Bill Clinton and Tony Blair. He spoke of wanting a third way between socialism and capitalism. He denied being a socialist at the beginning. And so, in fact, he retained the previous government's economy minister at the beginning, because he didn't want to rock the boat too much, which all seems very ironic, of course, given what happened later.
Yeah, how did he, when he finally made that shift and said, "Yes, I'm a socialist," how did he explain his shift in thinking?
It was it was 6 years into his government. It was around 2005 before he outed himself as a socialist. And the way he explained it was that it was sort of an organic process of reading and reflection. And he said that he had been kind of muddled at the beginning. He'd been sort of duped into this woolly version of a third way, thinking that there might be a way to work between capitalism and socialism, but that partly there was the 2002 coup against him, which the Bush administration had backed, had the understandable effect of radicalizing Chavez. Mm-hmm. He thought, my God, these guys, not just the Yankees, but even the Venezuelan elites, turned against him and used undemocratic means to try to oust him. He thought, obviously, I cannot trust these guys, so I've nothing to lose politically by becoming a socialist, because they'll never support me anyway. And of course, Fidel Castro became increasingly important. I mean, Fidel was a father figure for him, a political mentor, a consigliere, his chief strategist. And over time, Fidel became ever more important in Chavez's thinking. And Fidel would give him books. And Chavez, you know, originally had said when he came to power that he'd never read Marx. And yet by 2005, he was quoting Marx as if he'd read the books his entire life. So he kind of pitched this as a sort of Damascene conversion, which took place over a period of 6 years.
And in exchange for that tutelage, that spiritual guidance, Chavez made it very easy for the Cubans to get oil for not a lot of money.
Yes, I mean, he basically gave away, either for free or bargain basement prices, 100,000 barrels of oil every day to Cuba. And that actually continues to this day. And that has been a lifeline, a total lifeline for the Cuban economy, because the Soviet Union, its collapse had robbed the island of Cuba of its main support, and it went into desperate throes of contraction in the 90s. And then when Chavez came along, it was just on time, in a way, that to throw this lifeline to this day, it remains incredibly important to the Cuban economy.
Hey, Roy, I think we're losing your phone battery. We're going to call you right back. So we'll hang up with you here, and we'll get right back to you on the line. We're speaking this hour with Rory Carroll, former Latin American bureau chief for The Guardian. He's got a new book out called Comandante, Hugo Chavez's Venezuela. It traces Chavez's entire life and was published almost exactly around the time that Chavez died last month. If you'd like to be part of this conversation, you can send email to think@kera.org. You can send a tweet to @ChrisBoydThink, or of course you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. Again, my guest this hour, Rory Carroll. He's former Latin American bureau chief for The Guardian, author of the new book Comandante, Hugo Chavez's Venezuela. We are working right now to get a phone line back that we will all be able to hear what Rory has to say, so we appreciate your patience with that. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We've been discussing Chavez's life. We'll come back in just a couple of minutes.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, where you can design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in human rights, global studies, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Rory Carroll, former Latin American bureau chief for The Guardian and author of the new book, Comandante, Hugo Chavez's Venezuela. You can join our conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Rory, welcome back. We have you on the line now.
Hi, Chris. Yes, thank you.
Wonderful.
Apologies for that glitch.
Okay, so Hugo Chavez made this shift in 2005 by admitting that he held socialist ideologies. He also, from an earlier point, had begun to consolidate power, to sort of rewrite the rules so that he could remain in the office of president, although he was elected. Can you talk a little bit about that and how he justified those changes?
Yes, well, he was very smart at the beginning. When he was first elected, instead of going off on a spending binge or immediate kind of populist things, he invested his political capital in a new constitution. And his supporters at the beginning were flummoxed. They said, well, what are you talking about? Who cares? But he decided to, no, let's focus on rewriting the rules of the game. And he successfully had it passed in a referendum. And the effect of it was to increase, to allow him to run twice as president. Before that, there's only just one term permitted. And it increased the powers of the president. So he was now directly in control of the armed forces. And so he extended his institutional control over all elements of the state. And over his time in power, I mean, that was one of the most important things he did. He also took direct control of the oil company. And this is the golden goose that dominated Venezuela's economy, because traditionally the oil company was a state company, but it had autonomy, and the managers basically did what they wanted. They in some senses ran Venezuela, and yet Chavez was not going to have that. So he waged a big battle to take direct control of the company, and he won, and that was a crucial victory for him, because this gave him a huge kitty that, and especially after oil prices started shooting up from 2003, it meant that he had literally billions upon billions of petrodollars at his disposal. And he could rein those dollars over wherever he wanted over Venezuela. And so this really became absolutely crucial to his rule, because he had such powers of patronage. It was almost like the Wizard of Oz, as if he could almost make anything happen just because he controls the spigot of oil dollars.
How significant was the Chavez administration in giving out what amounted to patronage jobs?
Oh, it was the glue of his rule. It wasn't the only thing, but mm-hmm. It was one of the biggest things that kept him in power, was his use of oil revenues, because he not only spent lavishly, and arguably, I mean, he should have spent lavishly. I mean, this was a country of poverty and inequality, enjoying an oil boom. I mean, why not spend? And he spent a lot of it on the poor, but he spent it in a way that meant that people would owe gratitude to him, and certainly would feel that they needed to continue giving their political support to him to continue their access to this money. And this, he would do this, for example, by he basically doubled the state payroll. I mean, he kept creating new agencies, new ministries, new government initiatives, which meant that there were always more jobs to be given. Once you got a job in government, you wanted to keep it. And the one way to do that was to continue voting and to be seen to be voting for Hugo Chavez. Or you were signed up to some either scholarships or to some social programs, which often were sort of disguised handouts, but they may be accompanied with classes and so forth. But also there were medical operations. He built clinics and schools, and this brought real tangible benefits to the poor. And so if you're having your arthritic hip replaced by a Cuban doctor, you're grateful to Hugo Chavez for that, and you go and vote for him. So this was really, right up until the very end, one of the crucial pillars of his rule.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have Martin on the line in Fort Worth. Hi, Martin.
Yeah, hi, Chris. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
You know, your guest had mentioned earlier that Chavez had been elected, which really I don't guess anyone can argue with. But once elected, he changed everything. Like you said, he changed the Constitution. He went to the people, he used referendum, and the people didn't have the information that Chavez had, so anytime he wanted something, he could always go to that referendum and push it through, because he was always, like you said, the patronage dollars and handing out jobs and things like that. So my point is that wasn't he really, based on the way he operated in the government, wasn't he really just a dictator, but a dictator in a little different sense?
What do you think, Rory?
No, I don't think he was a dictator. I think he was a hybrid. He was part Democrat and part autocrat. And I think elections are a good example of this. The elections in Venezuela were were largely free, but not fair. And I'll explain that. They were free in that there was an opposition was legal. Opposition parties were allowed to organize. There was still freedom of speech. You still had quite a vibrant, although shrinking, private media that were very shrill in their denunciations of Hugo Chavez. And people were free to vote for this opposition. And there was no evidence, or credible evidence, of ballot stuffing or votes being stolen on election day. So in that sense, elections remained largely free. But they were certainly not fair, because Chavez would abuse or hijack state resources for political campaigning. He would dominate the media. He would basically sequester all radio and TV channels at a moment's notice to project his own personality cult. And also he abused institutions. Civil servants were obliged or compelled to attend his rallies. The head of the armed forces would warn voters, you will vote for Chavez or else. So that would create, of course, a climate of uncertainty and in some cases even of fear. But even so, people could still vote against Chavez. So I don't think he was a dictator. He was more this kind of hybrid character who genuinely retained the support of most Venezuelans. And like it or not, that remained the case right up until the end.
When you talk about him sort of commandeering the media, it really is astonishing the amount of hours that he spent on television in particular. Can you talk about the show he had on? Was it every Sunday?
Yeah, I mean, his media presence was ubiquitous. Before I can talk about the show, I will just say that he would be on TV. He could start the day by phoning in a radio show, perhaps, you know, not dissimilar to this one, to banter with the host in the morning, to kind of to set the agenda for that day. A few hours later, he would appear on television, maybe touring a tractor factory, and this would be all on live television. And then a few hours after that, he would pop up maybe at a press conference or some ceremony in the palace, signing an oil deal with a Russian company or something. And then later, at the end of that night, around midnight, he would phone in his favorite late-night TV show called The Razor Blade and banter with the host. And this was a host who used to kind of savage the opposition as vampires. And Chavez would have these kind of jokey exchanges with him. So he really kind of soaked up the all of the oxygen in the country, because at any moment you turn on the TV or the radio, and there he was. The centerpiece to all of this was his Sunday show called Allo Presidente, or Hello President. And this would start at 11 a.m., and it could go on till whenever. It could go on until sunset. It was a very freewheeling show in which Chavez was the star. He was also the director, the producer. He would actually be directing the camera angles. And there was no script. It was just him sitting behind a desk, or at other times riding a horse or a tank or being up in a helicopter, and him choosing the themes of the show. And this show could happen on the show. He would hire ministers, fire ministers, mobilize troops, launch new social programs, declare that he wanted to reduce the price of milk. He would say that he's going to build a new tunnel through a mountain, going to sign some gas deal with Argentina, and so on and so forth. And then in the middle of this, he would break off to dance or sing a song, recite a poem, reminisce about his childhood. He would bring guests onto the show and either kind of grill them or tease them and so forth. And this would set the agenda for the coming week. So in many ways, it was ruled by television. It was the Truman Show.
I mean, do average Venezuelans, you know, we talk in this country, and I know in Europe, about the importance of sort of gravitas for most national leaders. Is that viewed in a different way in Venezuela, or is it something that is considered less important as long as the people are getting nominally at least what they want?
Well, Chavez had gravitas, and part of his genius as a communicator was he was able to change gears so readily. He could do the statesman thing, and he would have on a suit, and he would look very serious, and he would talk about oil deals with the economy and social problems, and he would travel the world. But then in the next breath or the next day, he could play the clown, and then he would be, he'd be using very salty, bawdy language. He'd be reminiscing some time about when he had a battle with diarrhea live on television, and people would be kind of laughing at this, but also kind of horrified. And he could be quite funny as well. And it is this ability, this almost seamless ability to switch from the statesman to the clown to the empathetic leader to the, you know, to the rebel leader, kind of Spartacus type character. And he could do it all and make it all look like part of a whole. And a lot of Venezuelans were transfixed by this. They thought, my God, we don't know what sort of Chavez is going to get next. And so as a performance, he turned politics into performance. It was quite compelling. And of course, many other Venezuelans were horrified by this. They thought, this, my God, this guy's vulgar. He's an idiot. He makes us look terrible in the eyes of the world. But they were in the minority, and enough Venezuelans liked this act. They kind of bought the shtick that it was one of the reasons Chavez remained popular right up until the end.
So oil prices are up. All that money has been good for Venezuela. How diversified is the economy there today?
Not at all, and that's one of the tragedies of Chavez's rule. He came to power promising to diversify the economy, and that is something Venezuela desperately needs, because for decades it's been oil dependent, and if you're a petro state, it's actually very difficult to diversify to other things, because oil just creates its own dynamic, and it makes everything almost, it's easier to import anything than make it at home. And under Chavez, unfortunately, this trend, he put it on steroids, and because for various reasons, Venezuela's dependency on oil was about 80% in terms of foreign earnings, were 80% when Chavez took power. Now it's 94%, meaning that really Venezuela doesn't make anything. It's agriculture, it's industry, so much of what it could and should be doing just simply don't work, and all it is guzzling oil out of the ground and selling it mostly to the United States, and then spending the money rather than investing it in a productive economy. And so what we're left with is this, you know, kind of bloated, malnourished creature of an economy that's just sucking a sugared diet of oil revenues and doesn't make anything.
So to the extent that things changed for the poor in Venezuela, that's because of government subsidies and not because they're suddenly empowered to sort of get better jobs, get more education, that sort of thing.
Well, there's a psychological empowerment in the sense that many poor Venezuelans would tell you to this day that they feel that, thanks to Chavez, that there they had a guy who was on their side. Hmm. The president looked like them. He spoke like them. He was in their corner. And that was a very powerful perception, that this idea that for the first time in your lifetime there's a president who's on your side, and that perception really was the key to Chavez's political success. And in some cases, because he had so much money, he put more money in people's pockets. But his mismanagement of the economy meant that inflation went out of control, that there were no real proper sustainable jobs. It was more kind of handouts and subsidies. And so people don't really, it's not like being taught to fish. They were given a fish. And I think that's why Venezuela remains now trapped in this kind of populist labyrinth of subsidies and giveaways.
Broy, Chavez and his supporters repeatedly accused his enemies of somehow infecting him with cancer, and now they've launched an investigation into those suspicions. How much is publicly known about the course of that illness, the nature of that illness, and what might have led him to imagine that he was deliberately sickened?
The cancer is still shrouded in official secrecy. To this day, we don't know exactly what type of cancer it was. We know that it manifested itself in the spring of 2011, and that it was in his hip area, and that 2 years later it killed him. Beyond that, really we're speculating, because he went and had treatment in Cuba for pretty much all of that time, and Cuba, of course, is a master of secrecy, and they had good practice, a rehearsal with Fidel Castro's own illness in terms of how to manage it and how to let fragments of information, or in some cases misinformation, leak out. So really, we're still left guessing as to exactly what, you know, how the cancer evolved, except that we know the conclusion. In terms of the idea that it was induced, that it was somehow the United States had poisoned Chavez with cancer, it's clearly a ridiculous notion. But Chavez himself floated this about a year and a half ago, when there was a spate of kind of cancers or cancer scares affecting leftist leaders in Latin America. And he said, well, what's the CIA? Maybe they've been doing something. They've got some new bio weapon. And who knows? He said, I'm just putting it out there. I don't have proof. I'm just putting it out there. And now his heirs, Nicolas Maduro, has run with that, has really, within the same moment that he was announcing Chavez's death last month, Maduro also announced, gave birth officially to the conspiracy theory that this cancer was induced by enemies. He didn't name it, but basically he meant the United States. Mm-hmm. And many Venezuelans that I spoke to, I was in Caracas for those days and weeks afterwards, believe that, or at least they think it's possible. You know, you ask your Venezuelan, what do you think about this cancer thing? Was it induced, the CIA? And they went, well, you know, we got to look into it. We need an investigation to clarify this. Because, well, you know, there's so many suspicious things about the cancer. And so it's kind of sufficient for the government to kind of to muddy the water and just give the perception that maybe it was done. And this serves their purposes quite well, because it makes Chavez a martyr. And it feeds into the theology of his revolution that he was a martyr, that he was murdered. And that therefore he was sacrificed. His life was a sacrifice for the revolution. And this, for not all, but for some Venezuelans, is a very powerfully kind of resonant idea, because it feeds into its Catholic heritage and the whole idea of sacrifice and resurrection.
What do you think is going to happen in this election in a couple of weeks?
I think Maduro, Chavez's heir, will win. I think that there's still enough emotion and grief over Chavez's death to power Maduro over the finish line. Plus, Chavez had confected an artificial boom for his own re-election last October, and he did this by borrowing billions of dollars from China and by squirreling away money in secret funds, which could be spent in time for the election. And although this, and there's still the tail end of this boom, it's very artificial, and it's masking very serious problems, but there's still enough kind of money on the streets and in people's pockets for them to think that things are okay. So I think, and certainly opinion polls show, Maduro has a wide lead over his challenger.
Journalist Rory Carroll is former Latin American bureau chief for The Guardian and author of the new book, Comandante, Hugo Chavez's Venezuela. Rory, it's been a fascinating discussion. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, Chris, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is senior producer. You can download that podcast free at kera.org/think. Email comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.